Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. On this show, I interview some of the best progressive thought leaders and activists about solutions to the most important issues of our time. Topics include getting big money out of politics, achieving gender equality, transformational leadership, pro-democracy movements, current political analysis, climate change, and more. Today's guest is a national leader in all of these areas, with a focus on solutions that improve our communities, our country, and our world. Frances Moore LePay is the author of 18 world-changing books, including Diet for a Small Planet and World Hunger 10 Myths. She is the co-founder of three national organizations, including most recently the Small Planet Institute. These organizations explore the roots of hunger, poverty, and environmental crises, as well as solutions now emerging worldwide through what she calls living democracy. Her television and radio appearances include a PBS special with Bill Moyers, The Today Show, CBS Radio, and National Public Radio. She has received 17 honorary doctorates and the Right Livelihood Award. We met many years ago in Rome at the World Food Conference to End World Hunger, and we reconnected this week in Washington, D.C. at Democracy Spring, a pro-democracy movement we'll talk more about today. Frances Moore LePay, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. Thank you, thank you.
You're always in the right place doing important work. It's great to see you out there.
Thank you. It's been quite a week.
Well, let's tell our listeners, you know, this week we were both active in the Democracy Spring in Washington, D.C., and you were on the march that went from Philadelphia to Washington. Tell our listeners, you know, what is Democracy Spring?
Well, Democracy Spring is what I've been waiting for all my life. It's really a movement, a mobilization of citizens who are concerned, yes, about very specific problems in their communities and solutions to them, but understand that we can't make it to those solutions without true democracy, without decision-making for the public good answerable to all of the citizens. So it's just a wonderful, what I call, canopy of hope. It's a series of actions that taking place now this week and that I've been blessed to participate in, followed by Democracy Awakening this coming weekend, another mobilization that's very aligned with this exactly the same perspective. So it's a bringing together of all the different issue passions under, you know, a canopy that I think of as democracy, living democracy.
And that's so important. It is the central issue, really. It's, as someone describes it, the cancer underlying all other cancers.
Right.
You know, the fact that we don't really have a true democracy now because of the influence of money on our government, that we need to absolutely, essentially have to address this issue of real democracy in America in order to successfully address all the other issues we care about.
Exactly.
So you were on the march, the whole 100 miles from Philadelphia to D.C. Tell our listeners, what was that march like for you?
Well, I actually did walk 100 miles, but the whole march was even longer. I had the incredible opportunity to, I did walk 100 miles, but I had a break in the middle where, because I was invited to Wisconsin. And it felt as if I was lifted out of this March for Democracy and put in for a morning in Wisconsin with farmers from all the country in a cooperative, Organic Valley, that was actually living the kind of democracy that we are marching for. So it was an extraordinary juxtaposition of experiences. On the one hand, marching with our posters saying, you know, money out, voters in, and you know, real democracy now, and yet I was able to experience a taste of it with organic farmers who are part of a democratic cooperative. They love their work. They feel they have a voice. They cooperate with one another, 1,800 of them around the country. So it was beautiful. So it's like, here's what I'm marching for, and oh, yes, and Frankie, here's a little taste of it.
So it's possible.
Yes, and I think that break actually gave me, you know, the wind to carry on. So, but I am proud to say I walked 100 miles. I didn't even know that I could walk 10 miles. So, and I have no aches or pains. Hey, so Eleanor, it was so moving because in a way the ethos, the spirit of that march also embodied what we were working toward, because there was so much mutual regard and caring for one another and really sharing deeply. As we walked, there was a lot of talk.
Yes, I bet. And how many people made the march into D.C. with you there?
Well, we were about 200 when we actually got to the Capitol. We never went below 100, I was told. Mm-hmm. There were probably 80 at least, or maybe closer to 100, who went the entire way. There were, you know, a lot of people when I left that were there when I got back 2 days later. So, and one of the beautiful things, too, was that it was weighted, the population of us, it was weighted toward young people under 30 and elders. I mean, there were middle-aged people, but it was striking how the elders and the youth were the collective majority, I guess you could say, and such incredible pleasure in each other's company.
That's so wonderful to hear, and we know that a lot of the people in their 40s and 50s want to join in but often have jobs and family responsibilities and can't get away. So
exactly.
It's great to see that. And just so our listeners know, you know, this the march arrived in Washington, D.C. and began with rallies this Monday, April 11th, and the rallies are happening every day in Washington, D.C. at 11:30, and then marching off to the U.S. Capitol where there's demonstrations and civil disobedience happening. So there were over 400 people arrested at the Capitol on Monday, and 100 more each in the past 2 days. It's just kind of a daily keeping the pressure on. So if anyone's listening and wants to join in, please come on down. This is going to be happening every day in Washington, D.C. through Monday, April 18th. And Frankie, you were at the rally, and mm-hmm. you were actually participated in the civil disobedience mm-hmm. at the U.S. Capitol on Monday. Why don't, and I know when you spoke at the rally, you said this was the best day of your life. So tell us about that experience.
Well, let me just say that I was told by more than one person that seemed like they were authoritative that it was the largest single. There were 400 of us arrested. I was told it was the largest single civil disobedience action at the Capitol steps in history. So that
wow,
was quite remarkable.
That's impressive.
And clearly the police were not ready for us there.
Well, I think
they
knew we were coming because, you know, the organizers had been talking to the police.
I know.
And got the permit, but they had no idea that there were about 2,000 people and then over 400 getting arrested. So they didn't expect to have so many people actually go through with it.
Yes. And it was a beautiful experience because the police were very caring. We were very dignified in our actions, the way we held ourselves. In fact, I was in the holding area. They put us, I don't even know exactly where we were. It was the Navy Yard. We couldn't fit into any jail scene. So they put us into what felt like a hangar or some big warehouse or something with folding chairs. And I was there handcuffed from about 4 till midnight. And actually, people applauded as best we could for handcuffed the police chief and thanked the police for being so kind and respectful of us. So it was an extraordinary experience of people stepping up and exercising their democratic responsibility to call attention to the loss, the threats, and the actual loss of our democratic process. So I felt it was the best day because this has been so much at my heart for so long, Eleanor, and I've mm-hmm. felt I never had an opportunity to so be myself and say what I truly believed in the company of people who were stronger than I, strong spirits, and holding each other up. And it was transformative. I know that word is overused, but I will never be the same because of it, because I had that experience of unity. It wasn't like we are blaming and pointing fingers as much as it was. We are stepping up to take responsibility for our democracy. Because I think if we're all connected, we're all implicated. If we all, you know, benefit from this great country and we have responsibilities to step up. So if we have let things happen, if we have let, say, deregulation occur that led to the banking crisis that absolutely destroyed lives and ended up increasing deaths, right? Uh-huh. I read once that African American household, after the crash, the African Americans lost a third of their household wealth, right?
Devastating.
We let that happen. So uh-huh. We can't just point fingers. Yes, we must hold the financial industry accountable. We must hold our elected officials accountable. But that means stepping up ourselves and holding ourselves accountable to sound the note that there we have to bridge the big divides in this country. We made it very clear that our march was nonpartisan, very, very clearly nonpartisan. We were standing up for democracy.
Yeah, it's you're beautifully said, Frankie, and you've really captured the spirit of it. I love what's happening. There's such a commitment about really stepping up and stepping forward for democracy. I just love the whole spirit of the rally and the demonstration. There isn't the kind of anger and hostility that I've seen in past ones. So it's just really got a beautiful spirit about it, and I think that's really needs to be what we do to attract more people to participate, because sometimes that angry hostility can really turn off people who might otherwise want to join us.
I completely agree. You know, sometimes when I speak to a lot of young people asking me, what can I do? And I always emphasize in the beginning of my response that if you exude enthusiasm, excitement, and, you know, passion and satisfaction and joy, that you are focused on solutions, and I love that your program is about solutions, then those who meet you will pick up that, even subliminally, they'll say, you know, I want some of what she's got, right? Because everyone wants to feel connection with others, a sense of purpose in their lives, and a sense that they are powerful. And when they meet someone who seems to embody those characteristics, they want to know more, like, how did she get that? What's her perspective that gives her that energy? Because right now, so many people are despairing, and suicide rates continue to rise. You know, in our world, there are more people who die from suicide than from gun violence and civil conflict together.
That's awful.
And, yes, and it's so understandable if we're lacking those deep, deep needs. And so for me, when I say it was the best day of my life or it was transformative, it's because for the first time I can taste that idea that we are coming together on the foundational question, the mother of all issues. And Eleanor, you know, you and I met decades ago focused on hunger. And we knew then, we know now, that we can't fundamentally end hunger in a world of plenty. Now we have more plenty per person even than we did then when we met one another decades ago, that we can't address it unless citizens or regular citizens have a voice in governance and can use their common sense to take away the incredible inefficiency of elite-controlled systems that just are rife with waste and inefficiency.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about that. You know, we met in Rome many years ago, and I was the North American Regional Coordinator at this World Food Conference, and you were our star advocate on saying what needed to be done to end world hunger. So how do we end world hunger? You've thought about this, worked on this for decades now, and how has your view on how we end hunger changed since your first book on that topic?
Well, it's both much worse in a sense and much better. On the positive, we now have so many more examples, both of the social organization, the kind of bottom-up approaches of democratic decision-making that are working, And we also know so much more about the agricultural approaches that are working. Because, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it was just the beginning, in some senses, of the chemical approach and the, you know, concentrated, it was the beginning of the concentration of control over seeds and chemical inputs. And we didn't know how bad it would get, you know, how how much of a dead end that was. Now we have proof of what a dead end it is. And we have now a whole science of agroecology, the application of ecological sciences with traditional knowledge to the challenge of farming. So we know how to grow food in ways that is aligned with the earth, that gives us maximum nutrition and very, very solid yields. So, you know, the positive thing is we know what works, and we know how to spread this, even in the poorest regions. My favorite example is a community that I visited a couple years ago in India, in southern India, which had once been called the pesticide capital of the world because they used so much, and they were suffering. And they grew white rice, and and a lot of the people I talked to were tenants, and they got very little for the work that they did, or they worked for a landlord, got very little, and they lived on subsidized white rice from the government. And they were just weakened by the lack of nutrition in polished rice, and they didn't have much in the way of their own land to grow the additional, you know, nutritious crops that could help them be healthy. And so finally they broke free with a small revolving loan that they were able to repay, and began to shift away from chemical agriculture to what they call sustainable farming. Many, there are many names for it. The most common I use is agroecology. And so they started planting biodiverse fields, meaning that in one field I walked through, these are women leaders that came together. They meet once a week at 9 o'clock at night, the Deccan Development Society women, and they transferred from the monoculture of chemically produced white rice to these natural methods that they shared and taught each other. There were 20 crops in one field that supplied the entire complement of what we need in nutrition, from, you know, from legumes like lentils to millets, which are much more nutritious than rice. And they even now have their own radio station where they share what they're learning. They learn how to make videos so they can share what they're doing via video. And they've stepped up with others now in dozens and dozens of villages, and they've lobbied the federal government, the government of their state, to actually procure their healthy millets for the local school lunches, for example, and replace the white rice that is so lacking. I think it has the glycemic index of candy. So that's just one example of people awakening to possibility, and through joining together. And also it's changed the gender relationships. When I was sitting in that village, it was a young man serving us tea, by the way.
I'm glad to hear that. This is in India?
Yes, in southern India. And we're talking about Dalit, which is the caste. It's still, they said they don't have a caste system anymore, but there's still remnants for sure. And so these are the poorest people in India. And they told me if any man now beats his wife, that the whole group of women who are doing this, working together to solve their hunger problem, this group then goes and confronts the husband who hit his wife and said, no, your wife has all of us behind her and you cannot do this. And so it's changed the status of women. They have their own marketing cooperative now. And so I invite anyone to look at their website, Deccan, D-E-C-C-A-N, Development Society. It's easy to find, and read stories in English about what they're doing. And that is not a single example in that state. About 15% of the land now is moving in this direction with support from the state government because they see it works. And chemical agriculture just does not work.
Right, yeah, and, you know, all of that, it was the Green Revolution that they started with this very capital and energy-intensive farming methods, all these pesticides and chemical fertilizers and all that. And it did increase yields in some places, but then there was so many negative side effects in terms of what it did to the soil and what it did to the food that we're eating, which is causing a lot of the health problems that we've got, even here in the U.S. So
exactly.
Glad we're kind of now see what that is and can make better healthy choices. And you knew even back then, decades ago, that world hunger is caused not by a lack of food, really, but rather by the inability of hungry people to gain access to the food that does exist, and that we really have an abundance of food in the world. So you knew that then, but now you've added in, I think, this very important layer of the importance of the empowerment of people and the ability of people to have a voice in their communities and in their governance even, and to have a voice and say what kind of food they grow and eat. So that's a critical layer that you've brought in. It's really powerful.
And as I say, there are more and more examples. I spoke of India, but one of the more important examples in the world that touches also on climate change, as does all of this, because of course agroecology, approaching farming from an ecological point of view, also stores more carbon in the soil instead of releasing it into the air, and also it releases fewer greenhouse gas emissions. So it's a win-win on that score. And another example that has so moved me is the country of Niger in Africa, where the desert is moving south, land is becoming parched because of global climate change, and there, very poor farmers have come together and realized that if they nurtured the regrowth of trees, not planting trees, new trees, because it's very hard to get them to take, to really take off. So they're nurturing the regrowth of just sometimes a little stump in the ground, and they have to work together to do that, to protect it so that somebody doesn't come in and cut off a branch too early, because everybody wants firewood, so that requires a lot of trust and cooperation. And over time, over the last about 25 years, they have regreened an area of 12.5 million acres, about half of the farmland now in this very poor country, hit by drought, has been regreened with trees. So trees are combined with crops in the same fields. The trees actually increase the yields of crops. They don't compete, they increase, because they keep the soil bound, from and not blowing blowing away from the winds of the desert to the north. And they cool the earth, and actually the water table is rising a bit because of the trees. Reduce the evaporation of water and allow more of the rainwater to seep in. So it's quite remarkable what is being achieved that most people never hear of. And it's all about democracy with a small d, where the actual beneficiaries are directly involved in making the solutions happen. And it's about alignment with what we know about what the earth needs to thrive and what human beings need to thrive. We need to have that sense of connection with each other in the earth, with a sense of purpose, and with agency, a sense of power.
That's fantastic. That's so exciting to hear these positive models out there. A lot of people know you from your book, Diet for a Small Planet, which came out in the early 70s, and it sold over 3 million copies. I think at that point you were on the front edge of a wave of us all being more aware of the quality of food we eat, and also the connection between what we eat and our environment and our health. Why do you think Diet for a Small Planet has been so popular, and what do we most need to learn from it today?
Well, I think the reason, I was very surprised, by the way, I thought it would appeal to about 500 people in the greater San Francisco area, but fortunately others had better foresight than I. But I do think that what I learned, what changed me so much, is the response to that book convinced me that people do want to make a difference, and it's so exciting to think that the food choices that we make actually ripple out. First, they benefit us, to eat lower on the food chain, so to speak, to eat more of a plant-centered diet benefits us, our bodies, but also just it makes less weight on the earth, so to speak. So I think it was a very appealing idea that we can be powerful through the choices that we make. And of course, now we know that that's true in terms of climate change and so much else. So I think it was just I was just a kid, you know. I was 26 when I wrote it, 27 when it came out. But I think that I was just, what I was searching for is direction and something that gave my life meaning. And we eat every day, right? Multiple times a day. So it's pretty fun. It's pretty encouraging to think that each of those choices we make ripples out for good or bad. So I think that is why it has continued to sell and still continues to sell more than my other books. And I think that the exciting thing today is that this food movement and the democracy movement are so united that as I think of it, that what I call living democracy is a culture. Yes, it definitely must include a government in which concentrated wealth is not in the driver's seat, as it is in our what I call privately held government today, which can barely be called democracy. I have a hard time thinking about what we have now as real democracy because of the power of private wealth is so extreme in it. But my point is that living democracy is really a way of life in which those human needs I've already mentioned a couple of times can be met. And it goes beyond electoral politics to economic life. For example, in the middle of the march, and the reason I didn't march the whole way because I popped in a plane, and two of those days I was talking to organic farmers in Wisconsin who own their own work. They're part of the Organic Valley Cooperative. It has 1,800 farmers who love their work, have a say and sense of control and cooperation with each other, so they know they have each other's backs, and they're helping new farmers come on board because it takes 3 years to convert to organic farming, and it's becoming more and more in demand. So that's another dimension of my idea, or this very widely shared idea, really, of living democracy as something that's not just a done for us or to us in Washington, but it's the choices we make on a daily basis. And I think it's very exciting to people.
Yeah, that's great. It gives us a sense of control, really, in our lives and all of us doing our ones, whatever we purchase or whatever we're eating, that it seems so small, and yet when you think about the millions and billions of us doing it, it really adds up. And, you know, I think it's so instructive when you talked about, you wrote Diet for a Small Planet and you were a kid and you thought it might sell 500 copies, that you did it because you believed in it. And I see a lot of people who are trying to catch a wave or, you know, do what they think is going to sell or make money, or as opposed to what they really believe in. And, you know, I think we tend to always do better. If you follow your heart and do what you believe in, you're much more likely to be successful. And there's a great living example of it right there. But I love this living democracy, because we all think about democracy, about going into the voting booth every
right.
2 years or every year if you're voting in the local elections also, but that can seem so limited. And when you think about the living democracy as you talk about it, that's really about our daily choices. Every time we spend a dollar, what are we spending that on? Is that a socially responsible company? Are they being mindful of the packaging that they're using? Is it something we really need, or is this, you know, another thing that's going to add to the trash and the pollution on our planet? So, but if you think about each one of those daily choices, it's very exciting, because, like I say, all of us together making those choices really is what shapes our community and our country and our world.
Yes, and I want to emphasize that this is not a you should. This is not a burden. I call it, what you just spoke of, I call power shopping. That think of it as a way to gain power by this conscious choice. And so that's the opposite of a burden. In fact, that's effectiveness. That's meaning. And I once wrote a blog entitled something like, what did I call it? Instant gratification. Oh my, how you've changed. And I thought, you know, oh, people don't want to say, in this case, I was talking about hanging my clothes on the clothesline instead of throwing them in the dryer. And you could say, well, boy, that takes time. It takes more effort. But actually, the satisfaction, if you think of it, the satisfaction and honestly, the sense of, if you want, you know, sort of self-pride, that you can get by that simple act of, in my case, having a line off my back porch where I can hang my, and it's so nice to get out and, you know, it takes me a few minutes to stand out in the outdoors and do that. And it's soul satisfying. So I think we have to break this you should business and this, oh, come help me carry the burden of saving the world and invite people into greater meaning. I think that's the sense of it. And our families too, you know, really get our children appreciating how joyful it is to make choices that are more aligned with our values, how satisfying that is. And I think the more convincing we become to ourselves as we align as many choices as we can, then the more convincing we become to others. And so I think there's something really, I don't know, fortifying about that kind of alignment that we're talking about. But I don't want to overemphasize the individual because I certainly on this march to be part of a group, and whoever's listening, you know, I know there are people who are really worried and alone they're going to be vulnerable to despair, but by coming together and joining with others who are equally seeking, there's real joy in that. And I know we had, for example, we had here in our offices the local team going to Democracy Spring, and it was so fun to meet here and then meet up again in Washington. So that's the kind of thing I mean. So don't feel you're alone, because there's so many people who are equally concerned and wanting to move to solutions.
Absolutely right, and they're coming together on Democracy Spring in Washington, D.C. this week. So, and as many other places, and people can participate where they are also. But I love your whole approach about an invitation to greater meaning and living in alignment with our values. I call it action through attraction. You know,
oh, beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, when you're aligned with your values, you're doing what you believe in, and you're enjoying it, then it's very attractive. So, and then mm-hmm. you're taking action, and you can do more action through attraction for yourself and with other people. And I think that's really how we build a movement. And I love to see that emphasis and not the hostility and the fighting that sometimes, and the anger that sometimes animates movements. So this feels much mm-hmm. much more hopeful than that.
Oh, I agree. And I, you know, I lived through the 70s, and there was so much, you know, I'm more radical than you kind of attitude, and always trying to, you know, position oneself. And I don't feel that today. I feel the young people are bringing a very different, very appreciative, inclusive, what a spirit of whatever you can contribute, please come in. You're welcome. And it's really something quite needed and beautiful.
Yes. And just to be clear, we know with, you know, living democracy is about what we're buying and how we live and daily choices on a daily basis. And we still want people to vote. So,
yes.
It's very
important. Hold their, you know, and to tell their representatives that they will only vote, for them if they commit to truly stepping up to remove the power of private wealth over our political system. I call it privately held government is what we have today. And the mm-hmm. good news is that there is legislation now sitting in Congress that wouldn't solve it all overnight, of course, but it would make huge change. John Sarbanes has introduced a bill that has, I believe, last time I looked at it, 157 co-sponsors, and that it would allow regular people to run for office as long as they could show they had a certain number of supporters, small donors. They would get matching funds from the public purse, which is totally appropriate as a way to protect our public life for citizens. So there's way to do that, and there's legislation sitting there that would restore and protect voters, every person, one vote, so that everyone has access to a place to vote and able to vote. So there are really important steps we can take right now.
Absolutely right. And I was just doing stage management down at the Democracy Spring rally this morning, and we had Congressman Keith Ellison speaking, who, as you know, is the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Mm-hmm. And when I was, I thanked him for being there, and he said, well, yeah, he said, well, thank you for doing this. He said, people think because we're in office that we have juice. And he said, really, I mean, you need to understand you all have a lot of power, and we can only move things in Congress when people outside are applying strong and consistent pressure on it. So, I, you know, I think that's important. Sometimes we feel like, well, who am I, and I don't have a vote in Congress or whatever. You know, it is incredible how much the people in office will pay attention, because they need you, particularly if you're a constituent living in their a district, that they will absolutely listen to what you have to say if you speak up. So please use your voice and let your members know what you think about different issues, particularly on this issue of getting big money out of politics and passing that voting rights legislation to stop the voter suppression.
Eleanor, let me also mention that we created a online what we call field guide to Money Out of Politics movement.
You oh, great. To, what
just,
is that?
The website is just Field Guide to Democracy, and it's for anybody and everybody to see who's doing what, and it's organized by, you know, the approach of the group. Say, are they mainly focused on education, or they may mainly focused on direct organizing, et cetera. And it also is organized by entry point, you know, how you can get involved in the Money Out of Politics movement. So I really welcome everybody listening to go to fieldguidetodemocracy.org, and if there's something we've left out, where it's a work in progress, but it's a way to feel and see what is happening and see your place for you in it, no matter how much time you have, you know, and it, just talking about it, just talking about what you're learning is so important. I read recently about the founding of the Solidarity movement in Poland that started the labor movement overthrowing the communist regime, and they were asked, well, how did you make this work? And they said, you know, given that they was so controlled, and they said, we talk loudly at bus stops.
So we talked loudly at bus stops,
right. That's how they could, you know, because they, you know, it was a very communist-controlled state. And I'm not saying we're a communist-controlled state, but you know what I mean? Just sharing what you're learning. And I'm just so amazed, you know, when I'm standing in line someplace and I'll just pick up a conversation, or with a cab driver I spoke with in Washington yesterday, and he's coming to the rally on Saturday. He's going to park his car and come to the rally. So you never know.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, Samson. Yes, he's
coming.
That's
so exciting. Well, I love that. I'm going to go take a look at that fieldguidetodemocracy.org. That's exactly what we need. I appreciate you putting that together. And you also co-founded the Center for Living Democracy, which the 10-year initiative to accelerate the spread of democratic innovations, where regular people contribute to the solving of problems. And you did a fantastic job of getting really having a solutions-oriented news service and placing these stories of what the citizens were doing in half the nation's largest papers. So, you know, it's just incredible to me how much great work is going out there that doesn't get attention, because the media is so focused on what's going wrong. You know, if it bleeds, it leads is the motto of the media. And they're not talking about the many incredible solutions that are out there and the positive things people are doing. It's really not surprising people are depressed when they're getting hammered over the head with all these media messages at every level about how bad everything is. But talk a little bit about the work you did there with that American News Service and the focus on solutions, and maybe some what your favorite story is of citizen solutions in action.
Well, let me mention, that was one of the most exciting things I've ever been involved in. It was called the American News Service, and over 5 years we had stringers around the country, that is, journalists who are located around the country, and we produced 1,600 original stories. I want to emphasize that today another source of such things that I'm associated with, I'm a contributing editor to Yes Magazine. I highly encourage all who are listening to check out the Yes Magazine website, and they have a wonderful actual print magazine that you can get, and if you are near despair about things, and it's not just nicey-nice stories. It's really, edgy stuff about people working toward solutions. Our motto at the American News Service is we cover America's search for solutions. And, our stories covered everything from approaches to resolving gang warfare and what works and moving young people who are trying to find meaning, power, and connection and can only find it through negative ways, how they were helping bring gang members to find alternatives and are positive, all the way, to school reform. And I don't know, when you ask that, one tiny little thing I remember, just a really simple story, and I guess it is kind of nicey-nice, but I'll share it, is that in Chicago they had a program called Grandma Please. Grandma Please was a very simple thing that kids who went home to empty houses when their, if their parents were both working, there was a number they could call to talk to a grandmother.
Oh, isn't that sweet?
So they didn't have
that.
To go home to an empty house. They had somebody to talk to about their day. So, the whole range of things about democratic worker ownership. We did many stories on companies converting to worker ownership, and now in the world, more people are members of cooperatives than own shares in publicly traded companies by far. And so we had stories about the democratization of our economy through cooperatives such as Organic Valley that I just mentioned. So it was over the whole range, and I still hope that someday I can produce a version of that online.
Yeah, that would be awesome. And it's amazing to me how often you and I have tracked each other on hunger and solutions and democracy. I did a book on, just looking around the country for 20 years on what's working in America, and wrote a book on breakthrough solutions, how to improve your life and change the world by building on what works. And it profiles 9 in-depth case studies in different areas like education, crime, eliminating poverty, creating green jobs, and it just lays it out that we have these breakthrough solutions out there, but we're not systematically identifying them, and we're not communicating them effectively through the media or to the people who need to know about it. So maybe we can team up and see what we can do about doing an online version of what's working.
I strongly believe that, I just read a book recently by a Harvard professor who knows a lot about neuroscience and psychology, and pointing out, kind of obvious, but that hope actually reorganizes the neural pathways. And even once you have, hope because you've read something that is concrete, evidence-based solutions, that it gives you hope, and therefore your subconscious helps you move toward that direction, toward the positive, that we really can take charge of our mental map, so to speak, and that, as I often say, despair is the only enemy that we really have to concern ourselves with, and that we can take charge now and consciously choose whether, how much we really focus on solutions, and know that that's not just some personal comfort, but it actually can motivate us and help us see solutions that we might not have if we hadn't really been consciously focused in that direction. It really, we have to believe that we can take that step, and find others. Again, it's we're so modeled on each other that seeking out people who live in that space, sort of figuratively, who are solutions oriented, we become that more that way ourselves.
Right, that's powerful. I didn't realize hope actually realigns our brain. It makes a lot of sense to me, and I think it's very much what President Franklin Delano Roosevelt said. You know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And, you know, we can address the fear and despair, turn it around, and focus on solutions and work towards those. That is just a much more powerful and fun way to focus your life and animate your action.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to all those stories that you had? Are they archived in university somewhere?
They are on our website. So they are?
Okay, that's good.
They are accessible on our website. I don't know how easy they are to find, but our website is smallplanet.org. Anyone listening can go there, and we have a, you know, contact us function there, of course. So if you have any trouble finding, it was the American News Service. That's easy to remember. And if you'd like to see, you know, these are from the 1990s, but I think it's still fascinating. So, you know, we still have so many of the same issues. And
yes.
to read about some of these initiatives is very, very helpful now.
Oh, yes, and they're all still very relevant. And you mentioned the Small Planet Institute, and you co-founded that in 2002 with your daughter, Anna. So tell us a little bit about why did you found the Small Planet Institute, and what do you want to do with that?
Well, Anna and I, Anna LaPay, my daughter, we traveled the world in the year 2000 to write a book, Hope's Edge. And that title suggests the idea that we went around the world to meet people who were pushing forward the edge of hope. And so it was connected, definitely, the selective lens with people about, hunger, agroecology, that sort of question. We visited Wangari Maathai in Kenya, who started with seven trees and planting in 1977 and started the Greenbelt Movement to restore Kenya's land that was being devastated by deforestation and restore the lives of people who were not able to grow the food they needed. And by the time we visited, there were 20 million trees, and it grew now way beyond double that. So we visited Wangari and then in other countries around the world, similar breakthroughs, and wrote a book about it. And then we said to each other, well, this one book is not the end of it. You know, we want to continue to offer this kind of hope in action. So we founded the Small Planet Institute. Our motto is Living Democracy, Feeding Hope. And my daughter, based now in California, where she grew up, my daughter she focuses more on the U.S. food justice and food quality and all of the issues around that, has written two other books herself. And so she holds down the West Coast end of Small Planet, and our work here has been both on living democracy and on world hunger. So we share values and share a website, and she has other websites as well, but it's been great joy, as anyone who's a parent can imagine, to be working with my daughter.
I think that's so impressive, and I think it really speaks to you as a mother that you raised your daughter in the midst of doing all this amazing work all over the world to fight world hunger and to support and encourage democracy, and you are a very active mother, and that at the end of the growing up, your daughter actually wanted to be working with you. That's an incredible tribute to you. There are some mothers who I know their daughters won't speak to them. So,
well, I was really, really fortunate. And also, the timing was right just when I needed to get going on this. She was in grad school and really bored. And she wanted something exciting. And what could be more exciting than traveling the world talking? We ended up talking to three people who became Nobel Peace Prize winners. What do you think
of
that? So it was pretty extraordinary. So we that, and then sharing that experience was very bonding. And
that's fantastic. I'm so excited to hear this. And it's also, you know, next generation coming up. And
absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. We recently had the executive director of the group Results on the show, and he said that we have made significant progress in reducing hunger worldwide. Do you think that's true? And if so, why?
Well, it's more complicated than that. It depends a lot on how you measure hunger.
Mm.
That the UN defines hunger and measures it in calorie consumption, a calorie availability. The problem, as we know, is that calories and nutrition are parting ways. So people can eat a lot of calories but still not get enough nutrition. I tell one anecdote in the beginning of the book that I met, talked with a doctor who in southern India treats about 700 patients in his clinic, 2,000 patients a month in his clinic. And he told me that, you know, years ago, people were lacking in calories and it was a really hard problem because we need energy to survive. But today they have enough calories and they are lacking in nutrition so that 60% of them are suffering from diabetes and heart conditions. So it's hard to know how to talk about progress in that light. There are still, we looked at measures of nutritional, what we call nutritional deprivation. For example, the deficiency in even one essential nutrient. For example, iron deficiency is implicated in 1/5 of all maternal deaths. And 2 billion of us are deficient in at least one nutrient. 2 billion of us. 1/4 of all children are stunted. Now, stunting is not being short. Stunting is a medical condition that means that you have been deprived of essential nutrients in early life, and it has lifelong consequences for health and cognition. So that's 1/4 of our children who are growing up with some impairment because of nutritional deprivation in our new book, World Hunger 10 Myths. So it's very hard to know. Yes, there is progress in some ways, and yet that story from India and the continuing suffering of stunting and nutritional deficiency, even in very rich countries like ours, makes it very hard to feel we're making progress very fast.
Hmm, interesting. Well, I'm glad you mentioned your fairly recent book, The World Hunger, 10 Myths. I know that's a theme that you've talked about for many years. I was excited to see you've kind of revisited it with your experience and expertise over the years. What do you see as the major message behind your book, Their World Hunger, 10 Myths?
Well, it's still repeating the theme that there is no scarcity. And our second chapter is the myth that climate change makes hunger inevitable because, you know, climate change definitely will decrease production in some areas. So we counter that by basically saying there's so much waste and inefficiency and destruction built into our current new system, our current food system, that if we just improved in those categories, we could make up for any losses from climate change. Just to give you one dramatic example, we devote about 3/4 of the world's agricultural land to produce livestock that then return to us in calories, only 17% of the calories that we consume. Cattle are the least efficient. Cattle, of all the calories, listen to this, Eleanor. Okay, of all the calories that we eat in, all the calories that cattle consume in feed, we humans only get 3% of those calories in the flesh that we consume.
3%. Oh, my goodness. That sounds hugely inefficient.
Right. So will it surprise you when I tell you that actually India and China feed more people per acre than the U.S. agriculture does?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because they rely less on cattle and more direct food
sources.
That's
a large part of the reason. So here we think of ourselves as the world's breadbasket, et cetera, and actually we're feeding fewer people per acre than many what we think of as, yet undeveloped, you know. So just moving forward on decreasing waste that's built in, both that structural waste and the more commonly understood waste is, you know, just what we throw away, or the waste that comes from poor farmers not being able, they don't have the storage to safely store what they produce, so a lot rots, or they don't have a way to get to market with their food, so they simply don't plant it or don't harvest it. There's so much waste. Not to mention the, you know, the machines we refer to, where in the UK we tell an anecdote that was in a UN document about a factory that has a sensor on it, and any carrot that goes through that sensor machine that's not arrow straight is dumped out and fed to livestock.
Oh,
so
incredible.
Personally, I think that crooked carrots are just as yummy as straight carrots, you know?
Right, absolutely. Well, we're at our time here, but I want our listeners to know, how can they learn more about your work? What website can they go to?
Smallplanet.org. It's very easy to remember. It's a lot easier than my name. So it's a very rich website, and I think pretty easy to navigate, and just, you know, that you can read. There are short pieces. There are fact sheets. We love fact sheets to just get things down to some key information. There are study guides to our books. There are short blogs. There are videos, lots of videos of our speeches, but other things. So I just hope people will enjoy it and send us feedback, because you just go, of course, to our contact form. We also have a newsletter. Any of you listening, I would love to stay in touch with you. We quarterly, we don't bombard people every day or every week, but we do send out a quarterly e-letter. Often it has exactly the kind of stories that you and I are talking about now, of surprising examples, what I call stories of possibility, what we can do if we put on the lens of possibility.
Fantastic. That's all the time we have. Frances Moore LePay, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your incredible work.
Thank you, Eleanor, for your incredible work.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.